Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the National MS Society's Multiple Sclerosis 101 Conference. Your host this evening, Rebecca Gray, will now begin.
Good evening, and thank you for joining the National Multiple Sclerosis Society's teleconference titled Multiple Sclerosis 101. My name is Rebecca Gray, and I am a coordinator of programs and services based in San Antonio, Texas. In order to share this program with others who could not be on the call, it is being taped. All of you will have an opportunity to ask tonight's guest speaker, Dr. William Bradley, questions at the end of his presentation. Tonight's program will be a comprehensive overview of multiple sclerosis geared for those that are newly diagnosed. Dr. Bradley graduated from the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston in 1993 and completed residency and fellowship at Indiana University Medical Center. He has served on the Clinical Advisory Committee and the Board of Trustees for the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, Lone Star, as it has gone through its various mergers over the past decade. In 2008, he opened the Texas Multiple Sclerosis Center in Mansfield, Texas. Dr. Bradley, thank you for being with us this evening. Let me go ahead and turn over the phone line to you so you can get started.
Thank you very much, and welcome to everybody who's called in for this talk and to those of you listening later. Again, I'm going to, she said comprehensive, but it's hard to be comprehensive in 40 minutes. I'm going to give you my very basic patient overview talk, what I think you need to know about multiple sclerosis, and try and leave enough time for questions later. Since we don't have the direct interaction during the talk on the phone conference, please write down anything you've got. If I say something that goes over your head, please let me know. First and foremost, what is this thing called MS? Multiple sclerosis is a disease that affects the central nervous system. It's a disease both of the nervous system but also of the immune system. What happens is the immune system becomes active and starts attacking the nerves and attacking the substance covering the nerves, which is called myelin. You can imagine the nerves are being like wires. If you've seen wires covered with plastic, the myelin is the plastic covering. But in the nervous system, that covering helps the nerves work faster. The immune system also attacks the nerves themselves and causes damage. The areas of damage, when we look at them on scans, appear in little patches. The inflammation doesn't occur all over the immune system at the whole time, but it hits in little areas. And in older times, when we would look at these in sectioned brains at autopsy, they would look like little plaques or hard areas, and Latin for hard is scar or sclerosis. So that's where the term sclerosis comes from, and the fact that we would see them all over the place is where the term multiple comes from. In terms of what it matters to you as patients or caregivers, these little attacks in different areas of the brain or the spinal cord cause damage that keeps those areas of the brain or spinal cord from doing what they normally do, which causes the attacks that you experience as patients. A lot of times people will ask, well, what are the symptoms of MS? And as you can see from the fact that the attacks can hit anywhere in the brain or spinal cord, the symptoms of MS can be anything that the brain or spinal cord are responsible for, which, in fact, is pretty much anything that you can do. Common symptoms include weakness, numbness, fatigue, trouble seeing, trouble speaking, trouble with memory, trouble with bowel and bladder, trouble walking, trouble with balance, and things like that. So pretty much anything that can that your brain is responsible for can be messed up in MS. In different places and different times. What that also means is that anybody who's had any symptoms and goes and looks them up on the internet, one of the things that they're going to see is that MS is one of the possibilities. So I end up seeing a lot of patients being looked at to say, who come to me saying, do I have MS? I had all these symptoms that showed up on this MS website. Well, that's because all the symptoms show up on an MS website. How we figure out people have MS is then by the pattern that we see. What happens to them clinically, how do the attacks occur, and then also by doing the testing that I'm going to talk about a little bit later. Who gets MS is another question that people often have. About 400,000 people, based on the last estimates in the United States, have MS. About 2.1 million people over the entire world are diagnosed with MS. It typically is a disease of young people. It occurs between the ages of 20 and 50 when it first onsets, but it can occur in very young people, and there are children's MS centers around the state. And it can also occur in older people. The oldest case I've ever heard of being diagnosed was early 80s. I've diagnosed people myself in the 50s and early 60s. MS is the most common cause of neurologic disability in people who are young to middle-aged other than trauma. It's a little more common in Caucasians, and it has a geographic component as well. You may have heard about this. If you look at maps of population densities for MS, you tend to get more MS the farther you are from the equator in both the northern and southern hemispheres. So MS population is slightly greater in Canada as a function of the percentage of population than it is in the United States, than it is in Mexico. There's also a genetic component. It is not a classic inherited disease. So with a classic inherited disease, if you have it, then your children would have a 50% chance of getting it, and it's not like that. But there is a genetic component to it. People who have first-degree relatives with MS, that is a mother, father, son or daughter, or full-blooded brother or sister, have about a 3 to 5% chance of getting MS during their lifetime, which is not huge, but it's much greater than the 1 in 10,000 or so that it would be otherwise. If you have an identical twin who has exactly the same genetic material that you do that gets MS, your chance of getting MS would be about 30%. So again, if it were purely a genetic disease, that would be 100%. It's not purely a genetic disease, but genes are one of the factors involved. We also know that it's more common in Caucasians, as I said, more common in women. So there's a number of different factors. It's probably caused by a genetic susceptibility coupled with an environmental exposure, something you're exposed to, coupled with bad luck. You will hear talk about a variety of different forms of MS, and that's one of the things that's often difficult to navigate through beginning. So I'm going to run through them here very quickly. The most common form of MS is what's called relapsing remitting MS, and this refers to the way that the attacks occur. People get relapses or attacks where something doesn't work for a period of time, and then they get remissions where whatever problem they had goes away. Their arm goes weak for a period measured in days to weeks, and then it gets better. And then sometime later they may get another attack where they lose vision in one eye for a period of time, and then it gets better. Again, the attacks, as we talked about before, can be absolutely anything that the brain can do, and the remissions usually are almost or full remissions where the patient gets completely back to normal. But sometimes they're not. Sometimes you'll have some residual deficit that doesn't go away completely. The other, about 85% of people with MS initially have relapsing remitting MS. The other kind of MS from the outset is what's called primary progressive MS. And these are people who don't have relapses, but just sort of start going downhill and steadily get worse as time goes on. These patients can have periods of time where they get worse faster than others, but it's generally a steady downhill course. Patients with primary progressive MS are only about 15% of MS patients on the whole, and they tend to do a little bit worse. They tend not to respond as well to medications, and they tend to have more problems. And we're not sure exactly why some people get primary progressive MS and some people have the relapsing kind. Some people think they're actually separate diseases that look similar on MRI scans, but they can be harder to tell. A third form of MS that's very common is what's called secondary progressive MS. And secondary means that it doesn't start that way, but it becomes that way later. And this is what happens to a lot of patients that begin with relapsing remitting MS. At the start, they'll have relapses that will then get better and go away completely. But as time goes on, they start to have the development of disability, the development of problems in between the relapses, where the relapses aren't getting all the way better, or they're starting to kind of get worse gradually in between attacks. And eventually they'll get to the point where they're sort of gradually going downhill. They're getting progressively worse, either with fewer or no attacks or with no attacks at all. And they, at that point, they've become what we call secondary progressive MS. The data that we have suggests that roughly 50% or more of relapsing patients will eventually develop secondary progressive. The average time in an untreated patient to develop secondary progressive MS is about 10 years from the onset of symptoms. There's also a condition called relapsing progressive MS, where patients have both the progression and also the relapses in between. And this can be considered a form of primary progressive MS, or it can be considered the transition between relapsing and secondary progressive MS. But it's a term that's used for someone that's having attacks where they obviously get worse and then get better. But in, underneath those attacks, they're clearly steadily, slowly getting worse as well. A lot of people have heard a lot of things about MS when people tell their friends and family members they've been diagnosed with MS. They hear a lot of things, and some of them aren't true. And so one of the things I like to do is go over the myths and misinformation associated with MS. The most important thing I want to tell you is that if you've heard of a condition called benign MS, it does exist, but it's not something I want you to pin your hopes on. Benign MS is a condition where you get an attack or two attacks, you get diagnosed with MS, but then nothing else happens. You don't get any more attacks, and some patients can go for years without having any evidence of progression. And people who are diagnosed with MS often hear about this and say, well, I want to wait and see if I have benign MS before I start taking all these horrible drugs that I hear about. And we don't recommend that you do that because, A, it's very rare. Truly benign MS is at best somewhere less than 10% of all patients, probably less than 5%. And the trouble with it is that the drugs we have to treat MS don't fix the problem. They only help you keep from having more attacks. So by the time you've had more attacks and determined that you don't have benign MS, it's already too late to do anything about it. So typically we recommend treatment early on rather than waiting to see if you have benign MS. And yes, sometimes I'll get 5 years out with a patient that's on medication who hasn't had a second attack, and they'll wonder if they should have taken the medication. But I consider that a good problem to have rather than have them not take the medication and get worse beforehand. MS is not contagious. A lot of people wonder about that. MS is not fatal. People who are told they have MS think that they need to start making plans for estates and things like that. MS doesn't kill you. The disability can get bad enough that it puts you in a condition where you can die. It can cause you to be bedbound and have difficulty breathing and things like that. But it's not directly fatal, and it's not certainly not always fatal. It doesn't always get that severe. You're not Jerry's kids. People often hear MS and think muscular dystrophy, which is MD. It's not the same thing. The other major thing that I always want MS patients to remember is that MS is a disease that does get worse over time, and it creates a sense of desperation in patients and family members looking for anything that they can hang on to help protect themselves or protect their loved ones from getting worse. And when you have desperate patients, you have a great opportunity for people to prey upon that. And there's a great deal of quack therapies and uninformed treatment options out there, especially with the internet enabling people to go around and look for things that don't make sense. I always encourage my patients to go out and try and learn what they can about MS and about treatments that are available to them, but to come and talk to me if they see something that's not a standard type of treatment. Typically, my response to anything they want to do is if I don't think it's going to hurt them, I'm happy for them to try it. But there are some things out there that are clearly not a good idea and that may hurt you, and you need to be very careful about what you believe, especially on the internet. The example I'll always bring up at this point is bee sting therapy. There's been a lot of news out there in the past about bee stings being helpful, and every now and then I'll give one of these talks and someone will stand up and say, well, I had bee stings and it really seemed to help me. And that's great. I'm happy for them. But bee sting therapy in studies has not been found to be helpful, and it's potentially harmful because of the risk of allergic reactions and other things that can happen to you when you get the therapy. So we don't recommend that. There are other things out there that are the jury's out on whether or not they're helpful. And, again, if you can afford it and it isn't going to hurt you, I don't have a problem with trying it, but I usually recommend that you discuss it with your doctor. People also ask about whether or not they can get the flu vaccine or things like that when they have MS. And there are some diseases where flu vaccination can be a problem. MS is not one of them. The MS Society recommends that you do get your flu vaccination every year. So having told you all of that, we need to talk about what we can do about MS. The first thing I'll always start off with is, what can your doctor do about it? And the one thing I want patients to remember is that there are no right answers. Every patient's different. Every doctor's different. And this is especially true in MS. After decades of studying the disease, we still don't understand exactly what happens or why it happens. Just as I pointed out, we don't understand the difference between primary progressive and relapsing remitting MS. Why does that happen? Why do some people get it and some people don't? We don't understand. Figuring out MS is challenging as well. Many of you who've been through this process may have taken months or years to be proven that you had MS. As I discussed before, the symptoms aren't specific. MS can affect anything that the brain does, but a lot of other diseases can affect different areas of the brain. And so if you come in and are having loss of vision, it may be hard for us to figure out immediately that this is MS, or a numb arm or a numb leg or whatever. I routinely see patients that tell me they took months or even years before their doctors figured out that what they had was MS. Part of the problem there, too, is that the tests are not really specific or sensitive. An MRI scan that shows the lesions that look like MS is the best confirmatory test, but a lot of MRI scans show little spots in the brain for a variety of reasons. Migraines, strokes, head injuries, things like that can look sort of like MS, and it can be difficult to tell. Spinal tap is the next test that patients will often have to go through in order to get confirmation, and that's helpful when it confirms MS. If the spinal fluid looks like MS, it's very strong evidence that that's what this is. Unfortunately, roughly a third of patients in whom we know they have MS will have normal-looking spinal fluid. So if the spinal tap is normal, it doesn't help you. Another test people get sometimes is called evoked potentials, and that's electrical testing on the arms and legs. And that's also can be helpful, but, again, it's not specific or sensitive. It doesn't confirm that you have MS definitely, and if it's normal, it doesn't confirm that you don't have MS definitely. So it can be helpful as an adjunct, as an additional test if you need some convincing, but it's not a guarantee. Once we figure out you have MS, then we've got to figure out how to treat it. Since we don't know what causes it, we're unable to figure out how to prevent it at this point. The treatment has to be widespread. Treatments have to go all over the body because the disease goes all over the body. Most of our therapies right now aimed at treating the MS themselves are treated at modifying the immune system because we don't really know how to protect the nervous system from the immune system without losing the protection that the immune system is supposed to give us against infections and things like that. So we have therapies that modify the immune system. Another part of the problem in treating MS is that figuring out whether or not drugs work is very difficult because you need large groups to show effects, and so responses in an individual are difficult to evaluate. I frequently tell patients when I am putting them on medication is that what you're buying with these medications is you're buying odds. All of the drugs that we have right now were shown to reduce the number of attacks that patients get over time. But all of them were shown this in large volume, large numbers of patients' clinical trials. For example, we'll take a drug and we'll put 500 people on the drug and we'll put 500 people on a placebo. And what we'll see at the end of the time that we're doing the study is that on average, the people on the drug did better. And on average, the people who weren't getting the drug, who were on placebo, they did worse. But there will be people who were on the drug that did badly. And there will be some people who are on placebo who did well. And I can't look at any individual and tell them the drug is working or not because I don't know how they would have done without it. So what you're buying with all of these drugs is you're buying odds. You're buying a better chance of keeping from having further attacks, a better chance of keeping from having more disability. So let's go on and talk about the drugs that are available to modify this disease. Every time I give this talk, there's more drugs coming out, and so that's one of the things to be hopeful about. The first-line therapies that most people use are still basically the same choices that we've had for a long time, and that's interferon and glatiramer, or as you know them, the interferon drugs, Avonex, Betaseron, Rebif, and then glatiramer is also called Copaxone. All of these are shots that you give yourself at home, but all of them have been around for 10 to 18 years on the market, and they have good evidence that they work and are effective at reducing attacks, reducing evidence of MRI damage. All of them have data that shows that they slow disability progression. Some of them have a little bit better data in some of these things than others. But in head-to-head studies, they're all more or less the same in terms of their effectiveness. The one exception maybe being that the more frequent interferons, beta-seron or Rebif, may be a little bit better than the once-a-week interferon, which is called Avonex. The differences between them, Avonex is a once-a-week injection in the muscle. Beta-seron is an injection done under the skin every other day, and Rebif is an injection done under the skin three times a week. With the interferons, you have some risks associated with them, which can include liver problems, and a flu-like syndrome. When you first start doing the injections, after the injection, you can feel a little achy or sore, maybe run a low-grade temperature. These side effects are infrequent and relatively mild and usually pretty well tolerated after people have been on the drugs for a while. They're present with more or less all the drugs to some extent. The other drug, Copaxone or glatiramer, is an injection that's done under the skin every day. This doesn't have the liver enzyme problems. This doesn't have the flu-like side effects, but it's a shot every day. It's more frequent injections. You can sometimes get a side effect with it that causes chest pain, palpitations, heart racing kind of a sensation. When they did studies on this drug, they ran everybody to the cath lab. Nobody ever had a heart attack because of Copaxone. But for some people, it's an uncomfortable sensation, and occasionally it happens more than once. With all the drugs that are under the skin, the injection site can be painful and red and swollen. The intramuscular injections, as far as the injections themselves, are more painful because it's a deeper injection, but you get less of the reactions afterwards. And as I said, those are the drugs that most people will recommend for first-line treatment. There are some other treatments that are available. Probably the next most commonly used treatment is one called Tysabri or natalizumab. This is an infusion. It's a form of chemotherapy that you get done about once a month. It has a little bit of liver problem, but otherwise it's very well tolerated, and it works real well in head-to-head studies with Avonex. It worked significantly better, and so can be a real good treatment, except that there's a small chance of causing a condition called PML. What this is a virus that attacks your brain if you suppress the immune system enough. The virus is called the JC virus, and we used to only see this condition in AIDS patients who automatically have a suppressed immune system. And when the immune system would get suppressed enough, the JC virus would attack. It would start attacking the brain. And in those patients, it was always fatal. We began to see it in some of the patients on Tysabri and some other immune suppressive drugs. Occasionally, in those patients, it's not as uniformly fatal because in those patients, when we're the ones causing the immune suppression, we can stop it. And so many of those patients survive, but it still can be significantly damaging. It's not a good thing to have happen. The risk is highest in Tysabri patients 2 to 3 years after they start treatment. But beyond about 4 years, we don't have a whole lot of data because it hasn't been around that long. So we're not sure if that risk is going to continue to go up and up or kind of level off. The major thing to know about this is that it is possible now to test for the JC virus, and so you can see whether you have the virus or not before you start the drug. We think that the virus is present in about 50% of people, but that data is still being tested. But what we know is that so far, people who have not had the virus in their bloodstream have never developed PML. That doesn't mean it can't happen in the future, but it certainly means that the risk is a lot lower. Without knowing the virus status in all comers, they're reporting about 1.2 per 1,000 patients developing PML, so about a 1 in 1,000 risk of getting that if you take the Tysabri. The other new agent that has come out fairly recently is called Gilenya. This is a brand new drug, and its major advantage over all the others is that it's a pill. It's the first pill designed to treat MS. This is something that my patients have been asking me for ever since I started practice 14 years ago, is when are we going to have a pill out, when are we going to have a pill out? It's very effective in studies, maybe as effective as Tysabri. It looks very good. It's a pill form of a chemotherapy. It's a pill form of a novel agent. It's not a chemotherapy per se, but it does have significant immune system effects. The trouble with Gilenya is that it also has effects in other areas. It can have side effects in the liver. It can have side effects on the heart. It can have side effects in the eyes. So you need fairly significant testing before you're allowed to start it. When you start Gilenya, when you take your first pill, you have to wait in the clinic for 6 hours for us to monitor your heart rate to make sure it doesn't get too slow. We need to check you, make sure you're vaccinated against chickenpox, things like that. The drug has been out less than a year, and so I consider it to still be in kind of a beta test phase. I've got a few patients on it who failed everything else, but I'm still kind of waiting for them to get enough people on it to see whether or not it's really going to be safe to go forward with in the future. It's going to continue to be popular because it's a pill, and I think we're going to learn more about it over the next few years. There's another drug that exists called Navantrone, which is an older chemotherapy agent. It's given IV. It's a really powerful agent. If people having aggressive MS, it will stop it better than almost anything else. Its major problem is that it causes pretty significant cardiovascular side effects. So at most, you're only allowed to take it for a couple of years. So we don't use that one much anymore, but it exists, and if you hear about it, that's what it is. Those are the major treatments available to treat MS per se. There are other treatments that we use for MS in different situations. A lot of times patients will have need treatment during an attack. Many of you, if you were diagnosed with MS during an attack because something happened to you, you got weak or lost vision in an eye or things like that, you may well have been treated with steroids. We'll see steroids used a lot to treat exacerbations in short courses, usually IV. What we know about steroids is that they reduce the amount of time it takes to recover from the attack. For most attacks, they don't seem to make much difference in terms of how well you recover overall. In other words, if you come in and tell me your leg's weak and you can't walk and I put you on steroids, you're going to recover faster than if I don't put you on steroids. But 6 months later, you're probably going to be about the same whether you got steroids or not. The one exception to that is optic neuritis, or attacks that affect your vision. In those cases, the data suggests that the steroids do actually improve the outcome, improve the functional vision after the attack, and so we recommend steroids for all optic neuritis patients. Steroids can also be used in some cases on a monthly basis to help control the attacks. This has been done for decades. It was done before we had the other drugs I talked about earlier. Because steroids are cheap and readily available, there's not going to be a whole lot of studies done on them to prove that. But they're kind of a fallback treatment when nothing else works. There's a number of other treatments that are used, chemotherapy agents and things like that, that are used for patients who have failed all the more practical treatments. And I don't want to get into all of them there because everyone has its own problems. And if you're at that point, then you need to be having serious discussions with your doctor about risks and side effects anyway. The other side of treatment to know about is just the symptomatic treatments. Once we've treated the disease, once I've got a patient on a drug, whether it's Rebif or Copaxone or Tysabri, and I've dealt with whatever side effects the patient has, we usually get those under control, whatever treatment it is, pretty easily. The next step in treatment is dealing with the symptoms, dealing with the problems that come up. And as I told you before, there's a lot of different problems, but there's some that are fairly common and a few that have more specific treatments. There's medications available to treat fatigue. The most commonly used ones nowadays are the newer agents Provigil and Nuvigil. I'm also a big fan of patients when they're having a lot of trouble with sleepiness during the day, getting sleep studies. Fatigue is a common problem in MS, but we're finding also that there's a lot of underlying sleep pathology in MS patients, and if I treat that, I can help the fatigue that way. There's medications to treat muscle cramps, muscle spasms, which are very common. Depression is very common in MS. Some of the treatments, interferons, have been considered to be worse for making depression worse, but in studies, again, probably all the treatments are associated with depression because MS itself is associated with depression. It's depressing to have MS, but even besides that, MS seems to increase the risk of depression in patients that have it. Also, pain is a common problem as well. Recently, there have been a couple of agents approved to treat specific problems in MS. All the other things I talked about, all the medications for pain or fatigue or things like that, those aren't FDA-approved medications. Those are things that we use to treat those conditions, but the FDA hasn't studied them or approved studies for them specifically in MS patients. The two conditions where there are studies specifically in MS patients are for walking. There's a medication called Ampira, which has come out recently, which has been shown to improve walking times. I've got a number of patients on this. I find it to be helpful in many patients, but sometimes it's a little bit difficult to get covered. And then very recently, there's a medication called Nudexta that's come out to treat emotional lability. What that means is the inappropriate laughing or crying, the inability to control your emotions, which is another common symptom of MS. And this medicine, Nudexta, has been approved to treat that, and it can be very helpful for patients that are really troubled by this inability to control their emotions. Another mainstay of therapy for a lot of treatment for a lot of MS patients is therapy or rehabilitation. Physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, cognitive therapy are all kinds of things that can help MS patients recover or improve their levels of function. Physical therapy is aimed at walking and stamina and balance and things like that. Occupational therapy tends to be more involved with the arms and doing things that help you function in your daily life, shaving, eating, bathing, those kind of things. Speech therapy can be helpful for people who have trouble speaking or swallowing, and cognitive therapy helps improve memory and attention and processing and reasoning. A problem that MS patients will often run into is that the concepts behind a lot of these therapies are geared toward helping people overcome an injury. You pull a hamstring, you tear an ACL, you get surgery, you rehab it for a while, and you get better. And the insurance mechanisms are geared towards paying for that. MS, it isn't a single injury that you have to overcome. It's an ongoing process. And convincing insurers and convincing payors that to cover it on that basis can be tricky. But the MS Society can help with that. The MS Society has a lot of good wellness programs, physical activity-type programs that can be a real good resource to you. And if you find a good physical therapy place, they can sometimes help you with that as well. And your doctor can help you with that. So, what does all this mean to you? What I tell people is not to lose hope after hearing all this horrible stuff about what can happen to you. The term multiple sclerosis, the label multiple sclerosis, is not in and of itself a disability. The symptoms can be disabling, and they can be temporarily or permanently disabling. But in and of itself, MS is just a label. You need to work to determine how much you can do and both listen to your body but also push your body to get over attacks when you have them. My goal for my MS patients, especially early on, is to function absolutely normally except for giving themselves shots or taking their medication however often they need to. Work with your doctor to help you figure out how much you can do. Your employer and your insurance company may or may not be much help as well. But they can also, some of them have resources to help you figure out what you can do and help you maintain your function as best you can. What you can do about your MS is let your doctor know what's going on. As we talked about just briefly before, is a lot of the specific symptoms have specific treatments, from muscle spasm to pain to emotional instability to sexual dysfunction. But I can't help you with the problems if you don't tell me that you've got them. Learn what you can and can't do, and learn what kind of things get you in trouble. I have a lot of patients who come in and say, "Doc, every time I do too much, I get really weak the next day. And I keep doing too much, and I keep getting weak the next day." And so my first question is always, well, why don't you stop doing too much? Heat exposure can be another common problem for some patients. When you're talking to your doctor, prepare for that a little bit, and you and your doctor both can get a lot more out of it. Don't be afraid to call the doctor to ask questions when you need answers in between visits. That's what the doctor's there for. Don't be afraid to ask the doctor to make an appointment sooner than your scheduled appointment if you need one. And don't But also be sure to allow yourself enough time to get refills and referrals and things like that when you're calling for help. When you see the doctor in the office, the more prepared you are, again, the better you can get. I'll have patients sometimes come in with a list of medications and a list of questions that they want to ask me about in advance. And that's always great because that lets me know what kind of things I need to get through and lets me be sure I've covered all of their answers. At the same time, focus on the things that are really important. You know, 30 or 40 things you're probably not going to get through in a 15-minute office visit. But ultimately, don't be afraid to talk to your doctor. Don't be afraid to report problems. Don't be afraid to ask questions. Don't be afraid to tell your doctor you're having trouble with sexual dysfunction, or you're having trouble with memory, or you're having trouble with depression. Again, your doctor ought to ask about those things from time to time, but won't always. And if you don't tell them, they're not going to know what's going on. Finally, and most importantly, as far as living with MS, is to live. To live your life, do whatever you can do. The statement that you'll hear a lot from the MS Society is, I have MS, but MS doesn't have me. And then the last thing I'll go over is what to expect from the future. And the bad news is that MS is still incurable. We don't have cures, we just have treatments. And that progressive disability, fatigue, and other symptoms are common problems. The good news is we do have treatments. We can decrease the exacerbations, we can improve the disability. We can often stabilize patients and keep them functioning well for a long period of time. And there's a lot of new treatments coming out. There have been new treatments coming out just in the last couple of years, and there are a lot more in the pipeline coming out soon. 20 years ago, we had no treatments except steroids, and now we've got, I've lost count, 7 or 8 treatments specifically for MS, as well as treatments to affect the symptoms associated with MS, and there's a tremendous amount of research continuing to be done. If you go to the MS, the National Multiple Sclerosis Society website, you'll find something like 80 pages of different research studies that are just the ones that the MS Society is supporting. There's lots of MS research going on out there looking at lots of different novel treatments, lots of different kinds of things to help patients get better. The other thing to remember is that you're not alone. Whether you're a patient or a caregiver for MS, it's going to seem sometimes like you've got no one to turn to, like this is something you're having to struggle with in a vacuum, and we don't want you to feel that way. The MS Society exists to help you with things like this, and they've got a lot of programs that will be able to help you, from mentoring to support groups to wellness programs to things like that. The other thing I encourage patients and families to use is the drug companies. All the drug companies, if you go to their websites, they'll have support programs, and you do not have to use just the one for the drug you're on. Sign up for all of them. Get all the resources you can. And then use meetings like this, these telephone conferences, or when the drug company sends out things saying they're going to have speakers come around, go get help from those as well. We want you to be have as much support as you can as a board member for the MS Society as well as a physician. I spend a lot of time with them working to try and get new things or better help for my patients. So finally, in conclusion, MS is incurable but not untreatable. Modern medicine does not have all the answers. Your doctor can help you with your symptoms, and you can help your doctor with your symptoms. But remember, you're not alone, and that you need to live your life. I thank you very much for your attention at this point, and I'll ask the moderator to come on and throw it open to questions.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press the number one key. Again, if you have a question, please press the number one key on your telephone at this time. Dr. Bradley, we have no questions in queue.
Okay.
Well, this is Rebecca again. I want to thank you, Dr. Bradley, for this very informative presentation. For all of you that were on the call, I do have his speaker notes, and we will be disseminating those probably in the next week and a half. As a reminder to everyone, this is part of our monthly teleconference series. They are always on the second Wednesday of the month, so please consider registering for the June 8th program that will focus